I call this meeting of the House Labor and Commerce Committee will come to order. It is 3:16 p.m. on February 23rd. Members present are Representatives Carrick, Freer, Fields, and Hall. Please silence your cell phones. My staff, Evan Anderson, can help pass any notes if you need to. Thank you, Andrew Magnuson, LNC Committee Secretary, and Renzo Moises from the Juneau LIO for Tech and Teleconferencing Support. We have one presentation on healthcare solutions, and we also have one bill, HB 293, genetic counselors. We're going to start off with testimony on healthcare solutions. So first up, Lori Wing-Hire, the legislature's healthcare liaison, will lead off presentations from two states that have successfully developed state healthcare plans, and then we will hear from some expert testimony on what other states are up to. Thank you, Ms. Wing-Hire, for being here today.
Thank you, Chair Fields. For the record, this is Lori Wing-Hire. I'm the healthcare liaison for the legislature. And I'm going to begin, if it's okay with you, the two co-chairs, with a little bit of how we got where we're at, and because I think it'll set the tempo for where we're going and why we're meeting with the individuals that we are here later today. So getting my notes out here. So insurance, regardless of the type you buy, is based on the spread of risk, meaning members pool together and the risk is spread over all its members. This applies if it's health care, life, property, or any other type of insurance. The risk, or the cost of the risk, is the cost of the claims and is impacted by the health of its members. It's also impacted by the plan design. The plan design, for those that are not insurance nerds, is what the plan does. What does it cover? It's also impacted by the network agreements and the fees for those providers that are out of network. The concept of pooling generally works, or it should work. It doesn't matter if you're an employer, employee, a union trust, or in the individual market. Pooling should work. Unfortunately, some pools work better than others. Some pools are large enough with enough members to spread the risk that they are successful. Other pools are small and there are not enough members to spread the risk unless everyone is healthy and the claims are very few and far between. And some pools, generally those federally funded, Medicare and Medicaid, pay at a reimbursement that is thought to be less than the actual cost of services. Not in all the time, but sometimes. Just as important to members, number of members, is the proper administration of the pool. Proper administration includes accessible primary care, focusing on prevention, coordinated care, and accessing health care, the right care at the right times, strong network agreements that are broad enough to cover most, if not all, services and facilities while controlling costs, case management. It's important that members understand deductibles, co-pays, limitations on coverage, networks, who is in and who is out, and good communication at open enrollment where a consumer may have a choice in plans, which one is right for me, and finally, aggressive claims management, making sure the services provided match the invoice, duplicate charges, etc. All of these lead to the success of the pool, but they tend to be all the things we hate about insurance and insurance companies or plan administrators. As we know, the healthcare industry is continually changing. Technology changes, providing better diagnostics, better treatment for chronic conditions, or once were thought terminal illnesses. Members expect their plans will provide the benefits of new technology or breakthroughs in treating diseases, often not realizing the associated cost. So the plan is amended and the pool bears the cost, and that generally involves an additional premium. Technology and healthcare advances are but one piece of the puzzle. The puzzle has become more complex by a fragmented system, particularly in a state where access to healthcare is limited. As much as we have tried to be responsive to constituents and consumers, somewhere along the way, the system has been overloaded, and it has been so overloaded that it is now broken, and every single one of us is struggling with how to fix it. The question that keeps coming up is who's to blame? Did science and advancements break it? New infrastructure? facilities, technology, inflation? Being a rural state, is it just us? Are the local, state, and federal mandates, is that what's called, caused the problem? Is the ACA, or many refer to it as Obamacare, is it lack of health care access, lack of primary care, medical tourism, negotiated network agreements, the list goes on. Should we blame providers, or should we blame doctors or payers? The answer to these questions is yes and no. The ACA did a lot of good things, but it was never perfect, and unfortunately, as a former insurance regulator, I can tell you that one of the things it did not allow was flexibility for a small state. And while it threw a lot of money at insurance premiums, it never addressed the cost of health care. The ACA was perhaps the biggest change, the most challenging mandate of our lives as respects health care. Mandates come about because they are very important to members of the pool or your constituents, and if you look back, we had the Affordable Care Act, we had the No Surprises Act, we've had prior authorization, transparencies of fees, the 80th percent regulation, which is my personal favorite, pharmacy benefits, mammograms, enhanced imaging, elimination of cost sharing, telehealth, contraceptives, durable medical equipment, and we've expanded licensing to many licensees that did not bill insurance prior. Mandates, if they're local, state, or federal, come with a cost. And mandates are brought with the best of intentions because someone had a need. It can be your constituent, the provider, or the payer. They are not bad ideas, but they often have unintended consequences when it comes to the cost of health care. And then we have the lack of primary care providers. Primary care providers, MDs, DOs, PAs, APRNs, and even RNs are in short supply. Many Alaskans are accessing doc-in-the-box and emergency rooms for their primary care with the worst outcomes and the most expense. No doubt the cost of health care is causing insurance premiums to increase, be it Alaska Care, a union, Medicaid, Medicare, or an insured plan. It's a frequent topic down here in Juneau as we try to address access and affordability. We expect our plans to pay for all services, new technology, new pharmaceuticals, which are incredibly expensive, new facilities, but don't increase my insurance premiums. We have tasked insurance companies and other payers to negotiate the lowest reimbursement rates because we don't want higher insurance premiums. We want insurance to be less expensive, but we're not willing to give up the services we need or the facilities we need to access the services. Then we look at the providers, the healthcare providers. Some reimbursements are lower than they should be, and this is particularly true of primary care. And we have a tendency to not like change. In the healthcare industry, there's a hesitancy to change. A constituent may not want case management or coordinated care and may be reluctant to access healthcare through such a process. Another issue is the manner in which we reimburse. Insurers and other payers have reimbursed on a fee-for-service for 80 years, and no one's going to tell them that we're going to change that because they've done it for 80 years. There is some movement towards value-based healthcare, including and then looking at global budgeting and capitated agreements is another possibility. But there's so much to deal with. Electronic medical records, coordinated care. It's a trade-off. Continue though on the path we are on, or are we willing to accept new process? I've been asked to work with the legislature over the next few months and possibly years on looking at different payer methods. And that is what the presentation today is going to be on, is public option. I'm not convinced that public option is the correct one for Alaska because we're so small, but I do think we need to keep an open mind because I think the system we have right now, it's broken. And unless we break it down and start over and agree to some compromises, all of us, we're just going to continue down this role of playing whack-a-mole with healthcare. And our constituents, frankly, they can't afford it any longer. So with that, Chair Fields, I don't know if you have anything else for me today, but to introduce that you are going to talk about public option is one possible option that we're going to look at over the next year or so in how do we pay for health care so that it's fair to everyone.
Yes. Thank you, Ms. Wingheyer. And I'm going to suggest that because we have testifiers from across four time zones, out of respect for their time, we proceed through their testimony and then circle back to questions. And I do appreciate the testifiers taking the time. First up is Laura Kate Zeichen, who is the Director of Market Competition and Affordability with the Washington Health Benefit Exchange. Ms. Zeichen, thank you for being here, and we're going to try to queue up Teams so you can begin your testimony.
Thank you, Chair, and thanks, members of the committee. Are you able to hear me?
Yes.
Great. And I also have slides that I provided committee staff. I'm happy to share my screen if that's helpful, or I can just point to where I am if you have materials in front of you. Do you have a preference?
If you proceed, I believe our staff can proceed through the slides, and we can see you too. Thank you.
Perfect. Thank you. For the record, my name is Laura Kate Zeichkin. I'm the Director of Market Competition and Affordability at the Washington Health Benefit Exchange. The Washington Health Benefit Exchange is the state-based marketplace for Washington State. Currently, at the close of this last open enrollment, we have about 290,000 customers, or about 4% of the healthcare market in Washington State, who are enrolled through exchange individual market plans. These customers are folks who do not have access to health insurance through public insurance like Medicaid and Medicare, nor do they receive health insurance through their employers. So the Washington Health Benefit Exchange is really perceived as a safety net, and is where public option plans, which is the focus of my presentation today, that's where these public option lives, and public option plans are available to exchange individual market customers exclusively. So a little bit of background. I'm on a slide about legislative history now. Washington State is the first state in the nation to adopt a state-based public option plan. In 2019, state legislature recognized that healthcare insurance and healthcare was just too expensive and therefore inaccessible. And so it adopted a variety of affordability levers for the individual market. Public option was one of these. And it created a variety of things, including within public option, and included creating a competitive procurement process that is managed by our state purchasing authority for the individual market. And that state purchasing authority is the healthcare authority. It also approached the healthcare cost equation by thinking about and requiring a capping aggregate provider reimbursement at 160% of Medicare, as well as setting provider reimbursement floors at the aggregate level for critical access hospitals and primary care providers. After the passage of Cascade Care, which included public option in 2019, public option, or what we call Cascade Select, launched in 2021. At the same time that we were launching it, the legislature came back, recognizing some of the early implementation learnings, and added additional requirements to public option, including hospital participation requirements, which were not part of the 2019 legislation, and also requiring cost and quality transparency. The last presenter talked about value-based care arrangements. Public option is required to consider value-based care arrangements as well. I do think it's worth mentioning that the legislature set up public option through a tri-agency authority, so recognizing the different components of the and different authorities across the state, both state agencies like the healthcare authority, also leveraging an independently elected office, which is our Office of the Insurance Commissioner, which regulates health plans that are offered in the small and individual group markets. And then us, the Health Benefit Exchange, is a public-private partnership that is governed by a bipartisan board. And together, we implement public option through the healthcare authority's procurement and management, of those public option plans that are then offered on the health benefit exchange for individual market consumers. A few things, I'm on the slide around public option 101 now. A few things that are really important to note about the design of Washington State's public option program. First and foremost, it's important to note that public option in Washington State is not a state-run health insurance program. Instead, it promotes healthy competition among private insurance carriers who are voluntarily offering public option plans on the health benefit exchange, and they agree to these additional public option requirements that are set by the state in order to offer these public option plans. So that's a really important distinction, just straight up when you're thinking about what is public option. It can look like a lot of different things in Washington State. It's not state run. It is leveraging those private insurance carriers on the exchange. Currently, we have three of our 12 exchange carriers who are offering these public option plans at every metal in most counties. Again, public option plans are qualified health plans, so those exchange plans approved by the insurance commissioner and certified by the exchange board. It's one product of many products for exchange customers to choose from when they're shopping on the state online portal. As I said, carrier participation is voluntary. And in 2025, public option plans were available in every county. And for 2026, we went backwards. And public option is available in 38 of our 39 counties. A driver of that shift are provider network challenges, which I'll talk about in some of our lessons learned in just a moment here. The primary lever for ensuring that public option premiums are lower is the provider reimbursement target of 160% of Medicare at the statewide aggregate level. It's important to note that this doesn't include pharmacy. Unlike other state public options, this is the affordability lever. Our legislation does not include customer premium requirements. That is the hope that this statewide aggregate cap on providers and provider reimbursement will be passed through to the consumers, but there's no requirement around that. And then while carrier participation is voluntary, hospitals are mandated to contract with at least one public option plan. That is the additional criteria that were added in 2021 by the legislature. And so what that ends up looking like for the customers when you're thinking about the provider requirements is the public option networks are narrower from a customer experience perspective.
Ms. Zeichen, do you mind pausing for 1 second? Go ahead, Representative.
Not at all. I hate
to pause the fire hose here, but we're having a little difficulty getting the slides up here for reference. And I wonder if I may, if I apologize, you're speaking in great detail about the features of this, and I'm just kind of back to Cascade Care and Cascade Select. What is Cascade Select, please?
Yes, Cascade Select is the brand name for public option in Washington State.
Thank you. As I said, you know your stuff very clearly, very well, and you're providing a level of detail that is going over my head, frankly. So I appreciate the chance to ask a couple questions as we go. But that's a good start. Thank you, man.
And Ms. Zeichen, the presentation is flickering in and out, and I think the staff are trying to figure out why. But in the meantime, we all have hard copies of your presentation in front of us, so we are seeing what you're referencing.
Okay, yeah. I will.
So please proceed.
All right, excellent. And please don't hesitate to ask me to pause and ask questions.
I did not.
All right. I am on the slide now that says Cascade Care and Cascade Select. How are they related? And this may address a little bit of the questions that you just had. This really speaks to how the legislature set up public option. They set up public option as one lever in what we call the Cascade Care Program, that was created to increase the availability of quality, affordable health coverage on the individual market. So you'll see here that there are levers around plan design, so standard plans that the exchange designs in consultation with a multi-stakeholder group. And then are approved by the exchange board. There's also a state subsidy that was introduced on the exchange in 2023. This is state premium assistance for our low-income population. And all of these are working together, so by design. So really, public option is intended to address gross premiums. So taking those premiums before any assistance at the federal or the state level is added, public option has that lever around aggregate statewide hospital and provider reimbursement in order to try to bring just gross premiums before any subsidies are added down. Then, in order to bring net premiums down, so any so those gross premiums plus any premium assistance on top of it, there is this state subsidy for our low-income customers that applies to public option plans, and that brings the net premiums for customers as low as possible. And then the other key affordability lever here for public option plans is the standardized plan design that all public option plans must use. And that plan design is focused on lower consumer out-of-pocket costs, lower deductibles, lower out-of-pocket maximums, co-pays as low as possible and before deductible. That's how standard plan design is set up, and it's intended to make public option plans not only the lowest premium plans possible, but also create lower out-of-pocket costs for people who are insured in public option plans and using public option plans when they go to the doctor. So that's how all of this works together on the individual market, and specifically getting that affordability for public option plans. I want to pause there and see if there are any questions.
Not seeing any right now. Thank you for the presentation, and feel free to proceed.
Great. Let's talk a little bit about some of what we've seen over the years with public option. I'm first going to talk about affordability. So I'm on the slide that says Cascade Select Affordability. We know from our analysis since 2021 and reports that the legislature asked us to produce about public option, that public option plan premiums really show promise in being able to result in lower premium plans for exchange customers who enroll in them. We also are seeing that those who are enrolled in public option plans pay less out of pocket when they're using their benefits to access healthcare. So on that last slide where I talked about the plan design and then those premium levers working together, we're seeing really great results when it comes to out-of-pocket costs being lower, and we're seeing some promise and over the years when it comes to public option premiums being meaningfully lower. I talked about the requirement around the aggregate cap that carriers are required to manage for their public option providers. I will share that they're generally meeting those provider reimbursement requirements. But what we are also seeing is that public option plans, while they're generally the lowest premium qualified health plans available to exchange customers on the exchange, we're not seeing that they are meaningfully lower. They may not yet be driving down really significant premium rates on the exchange. And what you see here in this chart is the blue line are the public option rate increases over the years compared to all qualified health plans on the exchange over the years. You can see that especially in some of these earlier years, largely driven by the healthcare authority's competitive procurement that occurred for 2023, that public option rates were either flat or at a significantly lower rate increase than individual market plans overall. But we are seeing that creep up, and that's something that we're monitoring quite a bit.
Ms. Aitchen,
the good news, yes.
If I could just ask a question, I don't want to consume a ton of committee time out of respect for other testifiers, but maybe you could come back to us as I'm curious about your analysis of the extent to which your healthcare authority's negotiations mirror what the Pacific Health Coalition does in Alaska, and whether there's anything mm-hmm. we can learn about your experience. I don't know how much overlap in their functions there is, and again, I don't want to consume a bunch of time, but maybe if you could circle back, I would sure appreciate that. Thank you.
Yeah, happy to follow up. Maybe learning a little bit more about your model and working with staff, I can provide that information. So the good news is here that public option plans generally and relative to other plans on the exchange are the lower premium QHP qualified health plan choice for exchange customers. And on the next slide, if you look at Cascade Select enrollment history, lower premiums tend to mean more enrollment. And you can see over the years in that, I would say, brighter blue, it's called standard public option, that public option plans have been our fastest growing plans for the last several years. And that's largely driven by the premium price competition that public option offers, particularly as some of the federal requirements and expiration of enhanced premium tax credits and other changes at the federal level are making affordability less and less accessible, public option is becoming more and more in demand. And in fact, based on, again, this open enrollment that just closed for 2026 plan year, about 40% of exchange enrollment is now in public option plans. So that's about 115,000 enrollees in public option. And during open enrollment, about 22% more customers selected a public option plan in 26 compared to 25. So price really is driving enrollment in public option. We do have some lessons learned, and I'll close here. And I'll just note that in your appendix, there are also a variety of linked reports and more detailed lessons learned based on reports to the legislature and other analyses, but I think a few points are really important. First, we are very lucky in Washington State, particularly in this current federal environment, to have public option and to have a lever already established that really is driving relatively lower premium plans for exchange customers. Affordability and access is at risk for customers enrolled in exchanges across the nation, and that's very true in Washington State. So we were well positioned to be able to address premium price and we continue to be well positioned with public option to be able to address some of the access and affordability threats that are in front of us and our customers today. And that's really through, again, being able to address those underlying costs of care and drive healthy competition on the exchange through public option. So there's a lot of promise there and even more imperative to lean into this. We have also found that while we took, I would say, a measured, our legislature took a very measured approach to addressing those underlying costs of care through the aggregate statewide cap reference price for providers. We have seen that we could strengthen those provider pricing caps and realize even more meaningful difference in lowering premiums for exchange customers. And that's something that we continue to investigate and study. Provider engagement is and always has been the most challenging part of public option. We saw that early in public option implementation, which had the legislature being responsive early again in public option to provide those provider participation requirements. And those have helped in making public option more accessible to our customers. But we do need to go further if we want public option to be optimally accessible to our customers. And what we've also found is that in some of our reports to the legislature is that public option is not providing a material impact on hospitals' financial bottom lines. And that's something that we continue to investigate given the significant pushback that we receive from providers and particularly hospitals when it comes to public option. The final learning here that's really important in the design and implementation of public option in Washington State is thinking about the different authorities across your state and how they work together and making sure that there's maximum alignment in pulling every available lever across your insurance department, across across any exchange, across your purchasing authorities, to make sure that it's all working together as opposed to in conflict or not as optimally as possible, and making sure that the goals of public option are clear to all of those authorities and all of the stakeholders has been really important in Washington State. So overall, public option shows a lot of promise in Washington State, is providing value when it comes to affordability and access for Washington State exchange consumers, and shows a lot of promise and opportunity in being able to be strengthened, particularly in light of the affordability and access crisis that our customers are facing today. And with that, happy to answer any additional questions, recognizing this was a fire hose.
Thank you, Ms. Zeichen. Are there questions for Ms. Zeichen right now before we go to the next testifier, Representative Hall?
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Thank you very much for your presentation. I am having a hard time reconciling, and it was a lot of information. Insurance is not my bailiwick. How is it possible to have low premiums, low deductibles, and like how is that possible? Because I think I heard you say at the beginning that there's 290,000 members in the public option. It just seems like too good to be true. And I can understand what you were saying about the low cost being the driver for enrollment. Could you just maybe fill in my ignorance there, please?
Yeah, it's a great question. So on the exchange, we have about 290,000 customers enrolled today. Of those, about 115,000 customers are enrolled in public option plans. And you're correct that they are attracted to those public option plans because of the relatively lower premiums. In nearly every county in Washington State, public option is the lowest premium plan available to customers. And there's their public option has plan design that is designed by the exchange with a preference for lower a preference for lower deductibles, more co-pays as opposed to co-insurance, and more co-pays that aren't subject to the deductible. That is challenging for carriers, and all of the onus is on the carriers here because they are expected to work within, and now I'm going to get really wonky, they're expected to use that plan design as well as the healthcare costs that they're paying and reimbursing to providers in order to come up with a premium. The intention and what we're seeing so far in public option is that even with the higher value and higher benefit plan design of public option, it's really by bringing down those healthcare provider costs that's making the difference in the premium. So it does feel and seem like a win-win for customers because it is, and making sure that what's being paid to providers is meaningful enough to balance that plan design and balance utilization is really important in this equation.
Thank you.
Not seeing additional questions for Ms. Zeichkin. Ms. Zeichkin, I really appreciate you taking the time to share State of Washington's experience with a different state. Next up in testimony is Professor Dan Muse, Deputy Director of State Health and Value Strategies from Princeton. We're going to take a very brief at ease to queue up Dr. Muse's presentation. Dr. Muse, please proceed. Your presentation is up.
Super. Thank you so much, Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Dan Muse. I am a lecturer in public affairs at Princeton University in the School of Public and International Affairs. I'm also the Deputy Director of State Health and Value Strategies, which is a program of the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation that is located at Princeton University School of Public and International Affairs. I should say for the record that my testimony today is at the invitation of the committee and is not representative of the views of Princeton University or of the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation. Thank you so much for having me here today. State Health and Value Strategies, very quickly, is on the next slide, is a program, as I said, of the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation that provides technical assistance to states as they seek to implement healthcare changes. So, I have been working with states for about 11 years. Before that, was a state official myself in Rhode Island, and so happy to talk through public options. So on the next slide, and there's a lot of words here, so I just want to kind of, this is more of a leave behind for the committee than something that we'll run through everything on, but I think it's important to kind of ground ourselves in what is a public option when we talk about that, public options really represent a broad category of health insurance policies that have been implemented or kind of ideated in states. And so it's important for us to kind of tick through what we mean when we say it, and we can mean a few different things. And so I wanted to make that clear. So, generally, the idea here is that a state government, can use either regulatory or purchasing power or a combination of the two to lower costs and expand access. That it doesn't necessarily mean that you're using a government-run insurer or insurance program. However, there are options that might do that. So we can generally kind of fall into three pathways. The first, and this is really what Laura Kate spoke with about Washington, is a public option that relies on reimbursement limits, where state law or regulatory structures cap what a private carrier can pay to providers, and it's usually tied to Medicare rates. And by doing that, you reduce insurer costs and you enable lower premiums, and private plans is who is offering this. The second pathway is a premium savings target, and you'll hear about this from the Colorado experience. And this is where a state mandates that carriers have to meet specific reductions in their premium targets, usually kind of phased in over the course of a few years. Both Colorado and Nevada have implemented premium saving targets, public options. The third public option model is a public program buy-in. This has been described in some cases as a Medicaid buy-in or being able to purchase into the state employee plan, where the individuals would be able to kind of buy into that current operating program. It kind of having that that model where it might be less than what is available on the individual market. Generally, all of these models are kind of targeted at the individual market, who are the folks who are kind of most affected by very high premiums because they're paying their premiums themselves, sometimes with subsidies and sometimes without subsidies, and where you have coverage gaps. Now, there are additional tools to these three pathways, and generally these on their own are not considered public options, but there are ways to think about how they might fit into public option programs. So the first is...
Professor Muse, could I jump in with a quick question?
Of course.
So you say that these are primarily targeted at the individual market. Certainly in Alaska, that is a need. It is also a need in the state of Alaska. There are small public employers, school districts, municipalities. There are small businesses with the loss of ACA enhanced premium tax credits. Many of our small businesses have no path to provide health insurance to their employees. In these other states, do you also find that these, let's say, smaller employers can take advantage of state plan options?
So generally, yes. Because in those kind of first two pathways, pathway one and pathway two, because it's offered as a qualified health plan, that QHP on the marketplace, there is the opportunity for small employers to purchase those QHP plans for their employees. So you would be able to, you know, it is an available option for small employers.
Could I ask a follow-up, please?
Yeah, sure.
Okay, and I apologize for the timing with the internet.
Totally,
I don't mean to interrupt. In those cases, does, say, a smaller public employer or a small business acquire coverage for the group of its employees, or is it a case of the individual employees choosing to individually purchase insurance through the public plan? Thank you.
That's a great question. It can be both ways. And it's generally at the discretion of the employer how they want to structure it. They're kind of the traditional model for small employer purchasing is that the small employer would purchase for the group of qualified employees, right? Maybe full-time employees or employees with a certain number of hours. And you're purchasing kind of as a group and everyone gets the same, and that is how your pathway would work. There is an alternative model where employees would be able to kind of go and shop for their coverage, they can shop with a kind of a contribution from the employer. It's called through a health reimbursement arrangement. We call them ICHRAs, I-C-H-R-A's. And that is a pathway that some, very few, but some employers have used to allow the individual employees to purchase on their own. It's kind of similar to the how they would on the individual market. So there are these additional tools that states have added to their public options or might be considered. One is the standardized plan. Laura Kate talked about how Washington has a standardized plan. There are a number of states who have standardized plans that do not have public options, but they use those standardized plans to help consumers understand what they're buying Lord Lewenhire spoke about earlier, that plan design can be a big challenge if you have multiple plans. Different states have different numbers. I know Alaska has a relatively small number of plans on the individual market, but a state like Florida has might have over 150 options. And so if you're a consumer trying to figure out what are the differences between those 150 options, that can be a real challenge. And so by standardizing it, you're really comparing more apples to apples in the market. The other option is what's called the Basic Health Program. This is an option under the Affordable Care Act that allows states to kind of create a more Medicaid-like program in general, right? A state-run program higher up the income scale, so up to 200% of poverty, whereas Medicaid only goes up to 138 with Medicaid expansion. And the Basic Health Program takes those federal dollars that they would normally use on the marketplace and is able to kind of leverage those in to help pay for the coverage and keep it affordable. So I'm going to go to the next slide, which is the reimbursement limits. And I'm just going to spend a minute here because I think Laura Cade's description of Washington really dug in here. But right, you have a state law that requires those private carriers that are offering that public option plan to reimburse hospitals or other clinicians at a specific rate. But the private insurer still manages the plan, processes claims, manages that network with that state ceiling on reimbursement. I think, as Laura Cade mentioned, having the providers play ball is one of the biggest risks. Hospitals and health systems, especially in rural markets, might refuse a lower reimbursement. And so you might have narrower networks or lower access. And that's where there's this kind of requirement for hospitals to participate. I should say, like, one of the things when we're talking about reducing insurer cost structure, you're going to reduce premiums. You don't have to have a state subsidy, although Washington does have that state subsidy to get those premium reductions. One thing that's really important to consider when we're talking about public options is as we're bringing the premium down, if you are on the marketplace between 100% and 400% of the federal poverty level, so you're getting those premium tax credits through the Affordable Care Act, lowering the premium through the public option doesn't affect what you're paying out of pocket. The premium subsidies from the ACA are float with the kind of premium. So as your state's premiums go higher, the subsidies go up to keep people whole. As your premiums go down, the subsidies will float down with the premium. I don't know if any of the committee members have college age kids. I do. We think of it as the expected family contribution we know with college experience. So the how much a family is expected to pay for their health insurance stays the same, and the subsidy moves to meet that. Now, you can take that subsidy and buy up or down, but for that benchmark plan, that's important. So when we're talking about reducing premiums through a public option, we're really targeting folks who are not subsidized. So right now, that's folks who are over 400% of the poverty level, unless you can capture some of those savings. And I'll talk about that on the next slide, which is Pathway 2, which is the premium savings target. So this is the Colorado option. And as I mentioned, Nevada just started their option. So this is where state law requires that the public option plans are offered, and in Colorado, they need to be offered by every plan that's offering on the individual market. And you have to hit these premium savings targets to bring those premiums down. Now, what Colorado has done is they have a waiver through the federal government, Section 1332 waiver, that as those premiums have gone down, the savings that have been accrued to that a subsidy that floats down. So as the subsidy floats down, the federal government spending less money. Federal government will kind of send most of that money back to Colorado, and they can do what they like with it, and in Colorado they can provide subsidies to make it even more affordable for those who are already subsidized. This kind of maintains a competitive market. It requires the insurance companies to do the work of negotiating savings with the provider community. In Colorado, the providers, if they do not play ball, the Division of Insurance has some regulatory teeth to require, especially hospitals, to meet those premium savings targets and contract with those carriers. And both Colorado and Nevada have companion programs, so they have reinsurance that is also helping to maintain that insurer financial sustainability. I know that Alaska also has a reinsurance program. In fact, it's often the one that most states look to is I wish we could have Alaska's reinsurance program. So again, this is really targeted at those unsubsidized buyers who will see the full premium savings. However, if you're able to capture those dollars, that is where you might be able to see some additional savings for folks in the marketplace. On the next slide, we'll talk about the public program buy-in. This is not in effect anywhere right now. But it is something that has been talked about for a while, where instead of purchasing commercial insurance on the marketplace, you might purchase access to the Medicaid program. And this came from the idea of Medicaid's per member per month cost is lower than the premiums on our market. Why can't people just buy into Medicaid? There are similar ideas around the state employee plan that have kind of bubbled up in other states as well. And one thing that's really important is to consider what the effect of people buying from the individual market into those programs would be on the program, right? So Medicaid understands its population, generally how much that those folks are going to cost. If a bunch of people are now buying into that program and have different utilization patterns than what a traditional Medicaid program is used to, you might see changes to the risk pool. It might mean that, all of your Medicaid costs start to go up kind of on a per member basis because these new folks that are buying in are using more services. And that might cause problems for state budget or for interaction with the federal government, who is also paying a share of the Medicaid funds. I should say Medicaid or the state employees plan is not a licensed qualified health plan, a QHP. So all of the federal subsidies that are used would not be automatically shifted over so that you could use those federal funds to help buy into that program. You would have to have at least one federal waiver. And if you're talking about Medicaid, maybe two federal waivers, so that the state doesn't lose that premium tax credit funding, because as soon as you lose that funding, everything becomes unaffordable. Those federal dollars are key to be kept in the system for affordability across the market. Go quickly to the next slide. I mentioned these before, the standardized plans, right? This is generally where plans have to offer a standard template. So the deductibles, the cost sharing when you're kind of paying your co-pays or co-insurance, and the covered services are uniform between plans. What that really allows a consumer to do is to say, if this premium is higher, maybe it's because it's the broader network, or maybe it just is more expensive, and I don't have a good way of comparing it and understanding why it's more expensive, so I might go with a different plan. But that's really that kind of comparison. And generally, it doesn't require a waiver, and it can be implemented through state insurance regulations, and it can be implemented relatively quickly. And then the other option, that basic health program, again, this is a state option, so you do not have to submit a waiver for approval. You just have to kind of opt into the program. The state would receive 95% of the premium tax credits that would have been paid for that population up to 200% of the federal poverty level. And states use that along with their Medicaid contracting power to have generally near-free, very low-cost coverage. Currently operating in the District of Columbia, in Minnesota, and in Oregon. New York previously had a BHP. They expanded it, which required them to pause their BHP and move into a different program. And they are currently looking at going back to their BHP model right now. So let's go to the next slide. And this is kind of one of the things that I mentioned about the effects on the premium tax credit, right? So because PTC, which is the premium tax credits, the subsidies, are the difference between the benchmark premium and what your expected contribution is, those PTCs go up and down. And as the benchmark premium goes down, the subsidy will also go down. Now, one thing that that might mean is that if you are purchasing, say, a very high-value gold plan on the marketplace, and that's not a public option, as you're driving down the cost of the benchmark plan through a public option, the premium tax credit goes down, and that gold plan becomes more expensive in real terms to the consumer because their subsidy is shrinking. And so that is one of the challenges that has to be considered when a state is looking at implementing a public option. And so as those benchmarks go down and you're getting savings, that's when you kind of run into this question of, well, do I want to lose those federal dollars that are in my system right now, or am I just kind of creating more struggles? And I heard somebody speak, so I'll pause for a second.
Well, it might have been a glitch, but I actually did want to ask about enrollee dynamics. So
yeah, of course.
You say that the research suggests that many participants were switching from other plans, but my guess is that following the expiration of the ACA enhanced premium tax credits, there may be a different dynamic now. Is that a reasonable supposition?
That's absolutely correct. We are still gathering information on exactly what has happened kind of since the enhanced premium tax credits expired at the end of 2025. We have heard initial reports that we have seen a shift from higher value plans, the golds and the higher value silvers, into the bronze plans because of the savings, the cost savings. And we know we have seen folks also drop out of the market and choose to go uninsured.
Could I ask a follow-up on that?
Of course.
Anecdotally, we've started to hear from healthcare providers that health insurance in Alaska has become so expensive that people are actually dropping out of the workforce because Medicaid becomes the only way they can have health coverage for their family. And as we continue to explore this, I would be curious if that is a phenomenon we're seeing across states, because if so, that would substantially change the calculus in terms of state costs as we consider a state plan option. Thank you.
Yeah, so we do not have enough data to kind of be able to say for certain that that's something that we're seeing. What we do know is that it wasn't just the enhanced subsidies for the over 400 population who are now unsubsidized, although those are folks who are seeing real significant challenges, right? These are the kind of folks, especially folks in their early 60s, who went from paying, you know, maybe $400 or $500 a month for a plan for a couple to $1,800 to $2,400 a month for a plan that had all in that one plan would have, you know, something like a $10,000 deductible, right? That's really difficult to manage on what would be an income of under $100,000 a year for a couple. But at the same time, folks at the lower end, so folks between 138 and say 200% of poverty, those folks went from paying almost nothing or very low premiums under the enhanced model to having an increase. And that increase might have gone from, say, $10 a month to $75 a month. But for those folks, that $75 a month is just too much. And so they are not kind of able to afford that coverage. And then you have this question of how much less can I make and allow my family to have coverage through the Medicaid program. And that's a valid concern, and I could see how anecdotally that is something that providers might hear about. So very quickly, we'll go to the next slide and just talk about how to make a public option work in a state. And generally, there are kind of two things that states really need to be thinking about. The first is these Section 1332 waivers from the federal government. And this is where if a state does something that saves money and reduces premium, which then reduces the subsidy that are paid by the federal government, then the federal government will have an option to provide those funds back to the state to do with what they want. Reinsurance were really the first waivers that kind of fit this model. And by kind of capping the high-level costs for high-cost cases, you start to reduce that premium, save money, kind of build it right back into the system to make it work. Colorado is that first example of leveraging your 1332 waiver and your public option to draw down those federal savings because you saved money with the premium through that public option. Other states have been looking at that, and Nevada's public option also uses the 1332 to bring those federal dollars back to the state. Now, I should say most of the public option models, especially if there are either state subsidies or something that is novel, like the public program buy-in, would require transitioning to a state-based marketplace. And so right now, Alaska uses healthcare.gov. There are 24 states that use their own state-based marketplace, but it does require state investment in technology and staffing and a regulatory infrastructure. Generally, it's like a 2 or 3 year process to transition to that state-based marketplace. And so you really need that state-based marketplace if you want to capture the federal dollars to help support a state subsidy, or you're trying to purchase something that is not a qualified health plan, a QHP. So the final slide is just a very quick view of the states. We already heard from Washington, right? You have this kind of selective procurement. They have about 84,000 enrollees in their Cascade Select, which is a public option program. And so you kind of have this voluntary model, right? The carriers that felt like they could participate decided to jump in. And you don't necessarily have that regulatory kind of issue between an insurance company and the state as they're kind of arguing. Colorado became more successful and grew their enrollment as they added the state-based subsidy that was targeted at their public option. The Colorado option is this mandatory participation from all individual markets with the premium savings targets. 47% of the individual market is enrolled in a Colorado option plan. The mandatory model works, and you see reductions in premiums. It does create friction between the regulatory bodies and the carriers in that implementation. The Nevada plan just started this January, and so we're still really learning about how it's going to work in Nevada. Understanding how it worked in Colorado, we can draw some conclusions about how we expect it to work, but it will be interesting to see if there are different dynamics in different states when we understand how the Nevada program gets implemented. So those are all my slides. I'm happy to take any questions that the committee might have.
I do have a question. Thank you again for sharing your expertise. In Alaska, the largest consortium of health insurance plans is called the Pacific Health Coalition. And one question I have had is, would it be possible to stand up a public option or state plan that is sort of jointly managed by the Pacific Health Coalition with state participation? And as you could easily observe, we are a very small state. So when you think about things like standing up a state-based marketplace, we just face more constraints than larger states. So I would be curious, is it possible to stand up a public option through an organization like the PHC, which has the most sophistication in terms of negotiating lower cost care? And if so, how that affect some of the other options you were talking about in terms of necessary waivers, making sure we're not foregoing other tax benefits and so on?
Yeah. I think that, so the good news on the waiver, right, and which is a very robust and complex process, an expensive process, is that as long as you make, if your public option is still a qualified health plan, a QHP under the kind of structure of the ACA and Alaska law, then you do not need a waiver. It can still be sold on the healthcare.gov or Alaska, and you might just see kind of potential reductions in premiums or a flattening of the increase, right, over the course of years. I'm sure everyone would love a 2% increase as opposed to those increases that have been in double digits year over year. There's no reason you wouldn't be able to use the Pacific Health Consortium to implement a public option in Colorado, I mean, in Alaska. You would need to kind of think through what model, what would you be asking, what would the state be working in partnership with the consortium to do? And, you know, if you could say, you know, we want to set a premium savings target and say, you know, we're going to take 2025 premiums and say, you know, in 2028, we want you to be able to offer something that is roughly 5% less than what it was in 2025, with maybe some inflators for certain things. But try to hit those savings targets. Could the consortium do that? Are there enough alternative plans where providers would say, oh, no, we're not going to work with the consortium, or does the consortium have enough power to help to drive down those rates? Those are, would be the important questions to consider, as that would be in, to understand whether or not that would be an option.
Great. Are there other questions for Professor Muse? Professor Muse, thank you again for sticking around. I know it's rather late your time, but thank you for sticking around to share with the committee.
Absolutely. My pleasure. And I'm always here for questions if the committee has questions after today.
Great. I think next up in the presentation is Adam Fox, Deputy Director of the Colorado Consumer Health Initiative. Mr. Fox, let's see if we can hear and see you, and thank you for being here today as well.
Yeah, good afternoon, committee members. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Great. My name is Adam Fox. I am the Deputy Director of the Colorado Consumer Health Initiative, more commonly known as CCHI. CCHI is a nonprofit, nonpartisan advocacy organization and member-based coalition that works to ensure all Coloradans have equitable access to affordable and quality health care for and we do this by amplifying the consumer voice. I'm pleased to have the opportunity to speak with you to provide what insight I can regarding our experience in creating the Colorado option that Professor Muse gave you a little bit of a preview of. It's an initiative that we have been heavily involved in. While there are other hats that I wear in the health space, I want to be clear that I'm speaking solely from my CCHI perspective and expertise from our involvement with the Colorado option. Similar to Laura, I'll provide a bit of context and history, overview of the key policy structures within the Colorado option, and then, of course, the impact that we're seeing. I'm sorry I do not have slides for you this evening. But I'm happy to share whatever resources may be helpful, and if it's helpful to share a copy of my testimony, I'm happy to do that afterwards. So thinking about some of the history behind the Colorado option, not long after the first open enrollments under the Affordable Care Act, CCHI and other advocates in Colorado began analyzing potential models and pathways toward a public option that could further improve affordability and coverage in our state and really try to build off of the advancements of the ACA. And what Professor Muse just ran through, we were really trying to look at all of those options and what might be best in our state and what were some of the challenges and risks. This progression over a few years included analysis that we commissioned from our coalition, as well as a separate analysis that was commissioned through legislation in 2019. A 2020 effort to pass a version of the Colorado option ultimately was paused due to COVID-19. But we came back in 2021, and CCHI led a coalition of advocates and worked with the bill sponsors, our governor's office, our Division of Insurance, and other stakeholders to introduce and ultimately pass House Bill 21-1232, which has become the Colorado option. This legislation started in a different place than it ended. As you all know very well, policy and politics are the art of the possible. And negotiations led to quite a few significant modifications to the bill and how it's been implemented. But where we ultimately landed is a publicly regulated insurance option that is offered by commercial insurance carriers operating in the state. And as you heard, essentially the state sets the structure and additional requirements, but private insurance companies are required to offer the Colorado option plans in the individual and small group markets. And we evaluate that based on essentially a county by county basis. So if a carrier is operating in one of the 64 counties in Colorado, they have to offer the Colorado option plans in those counties. And whether they're in the individual or small group markets, they need to offer those plans in those markets. Since these plans are still offered and managed by commercial carriers, it means the state did not have to fund reserves for a true sort of state-run insurance plan, which would have required likely $70 million or more for reserves, not to mention staffing and operation. Ultimately, the costs for the first two fiscal years implementing the Colorado option was just shy of $2 million to fund additional State Department staffing, conduct analyses of the policy and produce reports, and fund actuarial work necessary for the design of the plan. There are really three fundamental components of the Colorado option and how these plans function. You have the premium reduction targets that you've heard about, but we also have the ability, as you heard, to set reimbursement rates with hospitals and providers. And I would argue that you ideally you have both. If you're going to set premium reduction targets, you need the ability to set reimbursement rates. And the third component is really sort of the required plan structures and improvements. Insurance carriers operating in our individual and small group markets, as I said, are required to offer the Colorado option plans, and they are required to offer standardized benefit structures, and there are additional culturally responsive provider network requirements for the Colorado option plans. I'll talk a bit more about those components in a little bit. And where we ended up is insurance carriers were expected to achieve a total of 15% reductions in insurance premiums for the Colorado option plans. Really over a three-year period, 2023 to 2025, that ultimately was aiming for 5% reduction each year, adjusted for inflation. And then going beyond that three-year reduction period, requirements to hold annual rate increases at or below the rate of medical inflation. And as I said, I think it's important to have the components, not just the premium reductions, but also the measures to reduce the underlying costs and reimbursements for care. And so the Colorado option includes reimbursement rate setting authority for hospitals and providers, and the potential to require participation of those providers in Colorado option networks through our Division of Insurance. Essentially, what we did is we set the floors for hospital and provider reimbursement rates within the policy that they can then be pushed to reach over time. Hospital reimbursement floors were set through a formula that allow adjustments for different types of hospitals with their different needs, whether that's a critical access hospital, a rural hospital, a trauma one level center, those kinds of things. Those floors are the lowest that our Division of Insurance could compel a hospital or provider to take under the policy if necessary. It's important to note that our division can't compel a reimbursement rate cut of more than 20% in a given year to prevent shock and harm to an individual hospital. So the reduction of reimbursement rates towards those floors, depending on the hospital and where they started with their reimbursement rate, can be a multi-year long process. The way this ultimately works is insurers submit early filings in March for what we call a public hearing process. And they indicate in those filings whether they expect their rates to hit the premium reduction targets or where they are in relation to those. And in this process, insurers can identify hospitals or providers that they see as barriers to achieving premium reductions in a filed complaint. What this ultimately does is it triggers a process and period of negotiation between the insurer and the provider or the hospital. And if based on the Division of Insurance assessment of that process and where the negotiations ultimately land, if reimbursement reductions have been successfully achieved or sufficiently achieved, the public hearings are vacated. If not, the Division of Insurance can call an adjudicative hearing, which will proceed, and the insurance commissioner can exercise his authority over the reimbursement rates and insurance rates to get closer to those premium reduction targets. I will be entirely upfront. The Division of Insurance has yet to need to fully exercise these authorities in a public hearing, nor have they set reimbursement rates, as the negotiation processes triggered by this process has generally yielded those reductions prior to the scheduled hearings. Essentially, my perspective is the insurers and hospitals do not want to go into a very public hearing where they have to argue to keep their rates higher and likely be forced to divulge information that may not otherwise be public. So the public hearing process has provided a strong incentive for insurers and hospitals to negotiate and reach agreement and avoid a public hearing. Shifting gears to the consumer-facing components of this policy beyond premium, the key structure is the standardized plan. As you've heard from both Laura and Professor Muse, this is a key component of the Colorado option. We require a standardized benefit structure with benefits that focus on high-value, pre-deductible services and services that can improve racial and health equity and outcomes. These plans have to comply with all of the same ACA requirements and be a QHP. But with a structure of benefits that is set by the state through a stakeholder process with our Division of Insurance. Because the plans are standardized in each meta level, it provides consumers a very easy way to directly compare plans across insurance carriers. And we know that many consumers shop first and foremost on premiums, and ultimately if the standardized plan provides the benefits that Coloradans want, it allows the consumer to shop with direct comparison on premium price, and then be able to assess other factors of the plan, such as provider network or drug formulary. There are limits, this goes to a question that came up earlier, there are limits to what we can do in the standardized plan design. Really, this is true for any state because of the ACA limits on richness of plans, known as their actuarial value, and ultimately the underlying assumptions made by the federal actuarial value calculator, which is probably more detailed than you really need to go into, but there are limitations on standardized plans that I think it's important to acknowledge. Even so, we've created a standardized plan structure with key benefits, including primary care, mental and behavioral health visits, perinatal visits, and diabetes supplies with no cost sharing or copays. In silver and gold level Colorado option plans, there's currently no limits on these copay-free services, providing better access to routine care to prevent a health issue from becoming more severe and incurring higher costs. There are some limits for some of these services in bronze level plans in order to comply with those ACA limitations. Prescription drugs are also offered in Colorado option plans only with copays, not coinsurance, to make out-of-pocket costs for medications predictable. And these the Colorado option plans provide better access to smoking cessation and diabetes self-management education programs at low or no cost. I'll note that because of the federal actuarial value calculator and those constraints, ultimately Colorado option plans do tend to have some higher deductibles and out-of-pocket maximums, but provide better low and no cost care pre-deductible. The Colorado option, as I indicated earlier, also includes additional requirements to improve quality, reliability, and cultural responsiveness of provider networks. These provisions include ensuring the Colorado Option Plan networks are generally not more narrow than non-option plans. They require 50% of essential community providers to be in network. That's above the federal threshold. Inclusion of certified nurse midwives, voluntary demographic data collection for covered persons and providers in the network, and more information about providers in the provider directories themselves. One additional policy component that Professor Muse called attention to that is crucially important to why we went down the path we did with the Colorado option is that 1332 waiver and generating savings.
Mr. Fox, could I jump in with a question?
Sure.
Does the standard plan include any mandates passed by the state?
It includes all of the, well, essentially all of the mandates that have been passed in the state are part of our essential health benefits benchmark at this point. So yes,
okay, is
the short answer.
Thank you.
So Professor Muse called attention to the 1332 waiver, and Colorado claims the savings from lowering premiums and therefore lowering federal expenditure on advanced premium tax credits. And we use those dollars to invest into what we call our health insurance affordability enterprise, which funds other affordability programs that make coverage more affordable. This has given us the opportunity, for instance, this year to implement the Colorado Premium Assistance Program to alleviate a little bit of the premium spikes that consumers are facing from the termination of the enhanced premium tax credits. So let's talk a little bit about the results. Professor Mew shared a little bit, but I'll dive a little bit deeper. What we see in the broader healthcare landscape is that Colorado continues to have one of the more competitive markets, with six individual market carriers and at least two carriers in all but one of our 64 counties. Prior to the Colorado option, we were seeing sort of gradual deterioration in our small group market, and unfortunately, in most respects, we've seen that trend largely continue as more employers struggle to afford and stop offering coverage or switch to out of the fully insured market to self-funded plans. I will note that we have been aware of some persistent challenges in ensuring small employers receive adequate information about Colorado option plans, which is likely contributing to lower uptake in the small group market. There were also some significant concerns as we were working on the Colorado option in the legislature that lowering reimbursement rates would impact the healthcare workforce negatively in hospitals as reimbursement rates were lowered, and particularly impacts on wages, benefits, staffing, training, et cetera. However, analysis that was required under the legislation to answer this question has shown no discernible impact on the healthcare workforce from the Colorado option. I want to be clear, that is not to say there aren't challenges in our healthcare workforce, but rather the broader market forces are really what are driving those. Regarding the premium reductions, there are some transparency challenges that I think we have from sort of the consumer perspective that make it difficult to assess exactly where each carrier is or is not meeting those premium reductions. And we know that while a number of carriers were able to meet the premium reductions for 2023 when it was 5%, a smaller number were meeting it in 2024 when it was 10%, and all carriers filed rates that fell short of the 15% reduction target for 2025. Admittedly, achieving 15% reductions in 3 years was ambitious, and ultimately the reimbursement floors for hospitals, as Laura sort of alluded to their experience in Washington, and hospitals and providers, those reimbursement floors may have been set a bit too high to actually achieve the full 15% reductions. I also want to clarify, as Laura indicated, that we do still see some premium increases in Colorado option plans. However, those increases have typically been smaller in the Colorado option plans than versus the non-option plans. And I think what we have also seen in Colorado, and this was really anticipated, I would say, is that carriers often work to keep premiums lower on their non-option plans to try to keep them competitive with Colorado option plans. So it has more of an overall impact on the markets where these plans are operating to push down premiums. Really zooming in on a consumer impact, analysis was recently posted, and I believe you all have the links to, by our Division of Insurance, which looks at trends really at mean monthly gross premiums, looking at marketplace enrollees who enrolled in Colorado option plans versus those who selected non-option plans. The difference may seem small, because the premium amount difference amounts to roughly $33 a month for bronze plans, $18 a month for silver plans, and $14 a month in gold plans. But when you think about what I just said a moment ago about carriers having tried to make their non-option plans more competitive and minimize that divide, it makes more sense. Importantly, the analysis also notes that Colorado option enrollees were estimated to spend $222 less in out-of-pocket costs compared to similar non-option enrollees. And researchers from Brown University also found that relative to 2020, monthly inflation-adjusted premiums for the lowest and second lowest cost silver plans in Colorado are more than $100 lower than the corresponding premiums in comparison states. You heard Professor Muse highlight the level of enrollment that we've seen in Colorado option, and I think this is really how one of the most important metrics to measure its success. He indicated that we are at 47% of our individual market enrolling in Colorado option. It is actually now 50% based on 2026 initial data from Connect for Health Colorado. And that means really in 4 years, Colorado option plans have become the plan of choice for half of Connect for Health Colorado enrollees. And it's clear that these plans are popular and provide a value proposition that a significant portion of consumers appreciate. I think this is really due to three fundamental reasons. And this is largely echoed in the analysis. Coloradans see the value in the standardized benefits and access to high value, pre-deductible, copay-free services that are predictable, and consumers also appreciate the ability to directly compare the Colorado option plans between insurance carriers without having to morass the quantity of variations and benefits in other plans. And fundamentally, consumers shop on premium, and as premium reductions progress, the Colorado option plans become increasingly competitive and attractive in the market. And similar to Laura, while Coloradans are still grappling with significant premium increases from the termination of enhanced premium tax credits, the combination of Colorado option plans, effective insurance rate review at the state level, and our Colorado Premium Assistance Program from our 1332 waiver, these have really provided some better, more affordable options in a moment of significant market disruption. And based on initial enrollment submissions, Colorado lost about 2% of our enrollees so far, compared to 4% on average for other state-based marketplaces and 5% decline nationally through healthcare.gov. I realize you have absorbed and been presented with a ton of information from a variety of perspectives, and I'm happy to answer any questions that you might have along with the other panelists.
Great. Ms. Winghire, would you mind coming up in case committee members have questions for you as well? Do committee members have questions for Mr. Fox, Professor Muse, or Ms. Zeitschken? And I would just mention, while you ponder that, you know, sitting here, I've been thinking one potential next hearing we could have, and I think we would value your input, is we could ask Ms. Winghire and Alaska stakeholders to consider what is most applicable and perhaps not applicable, but about what these other states have done. That's one option that springs to mind. And please give us your feedback if you have other thoughts on next steps as we explore what other states have done. At this time, do committee members have questions? We do have one more bill as well once we go through this presentation. Representative Carrick.
Yes, to the co-chair, I just really like that idea for a next step as a committee. I think it would be really good hearing about these other states' plans to now see where Alaska is different and what might be applicable to our state, what might not be as applicable. And I think Ms. Swinghire is just the perfect person to do that for us.
Thank you, Representative Carrick. Chair Fields, if I might, again, this is Lori Winghire. I'm the healthcare liaison for the legislature. I listened to all three presenters, and the one thing I heard was that they set the reimbursement rates for providers. And some of them talked about rates that if we could get to those in Alaska, we probably wouldn't have to have this conversation. So that you know, the three of you that have been presenting, if you are out of network in Alaska, we pay at 185 of Medicare. And I, you know, heard some of you in some of the presentations say go to 100, 135, or somewhere around, or 160%. And with our small population, and it is a little bit higher cost here, I can't imagine primary care or having a sustainable health care system with some of those rates. If it was just as simple as setting rates for health care providers, I think we could do that. But that's the problem is, I mean, there's others too, don't get me wrong. But that's is how do we keep a sustainable health care workforce and facilities and such, and then address the rates that they're paying in Colorado or Washington. Do I think we can do better? Yes, I do. But I'm not convinced that we're going to get a warm reception with some of those reimbursement rates from some of our providers.
Great. And one other thing, Mr. Fox, you kind of described what I think sounds like a kind of a two-pronged approach of very affordable primary care with what may be, as a layperson, I would describe as catastrophic coverage on insurance. And as I've thought about what we could strive for in Alaska, you know, that is kind of immediately what sprang to mind. And the Pacific Health Coalition does have free primary care for a lot of their plan participants, including those of us who are employees of the state of Alaska. So that was a really interesting model that jumped out at me. Do committee members have other questions? Okay, thank you again to Mr. Fox, Professor Muse, Ms. Zeichkin for tuning in some cases very late in your day. And thanks to Ms. Wing-Hire for being here, and we will schedule a follow-up hearing. The last item on our agenda today is House Bill 293, Genetic Counseling. The deadline for amendments was 5 p.m. on February 16th. I believe we have seven amendments to consider. Monty Worthington, who testifies as a genetic counselor, is available because I thought it would be valuable to hear feedback on the amendments from genetic counselors. So at this time, I am going to move Amendment 1.
I object for the purposes of discussion.
So this amendment responds to some committee questions and concerns around costs, and it simply clarifies that Genetic Counseling Advisory Committee members are not entitled to travel and per diem reimbursement. So the idea is we want their input. We don't want it to cost money. Hopefully this amendment strikes that balance. Are there questions on this amendment? Okay. Representative Hall, do you maintain your objection?
I do not.
Is there further objection on Amendment 1? Seeing no further objection, Amendment 1 passes. At this time, I believe Representative Carrick is not offering Amendment 2 or A.2. Is that correct, Representative Carrick?
That's correct. I'm not offering Amendment 2.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Carrick. Next, I will move Amendment 3 or A.3.
I object for the purposes of discussion.
Thank you. This amendment cleans up the transition section to say that certified genetic counselors may be appointed to the advisory council before they've obtained their professional licensure and may continue to serve out their term if they obtain their license by July 1, 2027. Obviously, this is necessary if we are going to have the regulatory structure as proposed by genetic counselors. Are there any questions on this amendment?
Mr. Chairman, could you have a brief at ease?
Yes, Representative Sadler, we will go Thank briefly you. At ease. Back on the record, still on Amendment 3 or A.3, I believe Representative Sadler might have a question or comment.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I'm looking at Amendment 3, A.3, and it speaks on line 7 of a person who is engaged in the practice of genetic counseling. Where is it in statute the definition of the practice of genetic counseling?
I might ask my staff, Evan Anderson, to discuss that.
Because what we have here is before the effective date of the act, which I think establishes the practice of genetic counseling, but I may be mistaken.
For the record, Evan Anderson, staff to Rep. Fields, to Representative Sadler through the chair. If I understood your question, I think we're defining genetic counselors in section 4 of the bill. I don't know if I can further answer.
Does that answer your question, Representative Sadler?
I think what I see here is we see someone engaged in the practice of genetic counseling on the day before the effective date of the act. I guess my question is a little bit tautologically based. If the act has not gone into effect effecting Section 4, creating the practice of genetic counseling, how can we have a person engaged in the practice of genetic counseling before that time?
Go ahead. Do you want to should we hear from Sylvan Robb?
It's a bill drafting thing, just trying to find out.
Okay. Yeah. Go ahead, Evan Anderson.
For the record, Evan Anderson to Representative Sadler through the chair. My understanding of this amendment, this was actually flagged by the drafter. The intent here is the state medical board meets very frequently. They meet, I think, monthly. And so when this bill is effective in law, that's when the requirements begin to stand up the Genetic Counseling Advisory Council. So at that point, this bill will be in law. However, the bill has a 1 year there's 1 year that all the genetic counselors have to, I believe it's 1 year, before they have a licensure requirement. The text of the bill requires that all genetic counselors who serve on the Genetic Counseling Advisory Council are licensed genetic counselors, and that will still be true into the future. However, this just deals with that very first year of implementation where genetic counselors may not yet be licensed because we've just created a licensure process for them. And so this just allows them to serve on the advisory council during that time.
I'm sorry, I'm afraid I did not follow that. Again, my question is, it seems like, does the practice of genetic counseling become a practice in law on the effective date of this act or some other way?
Go ahead, Ms. Rand.
Through the chair, to Representative Sadler, yes, my understanding is that on the effective date of this law, that genetic counselors, sorry, I kind of lost my train of thought.
Representative Sadler, I think because of the fact that we are establishing licensure,
right,
and we have an advisory board to the state medical board, we do have to have a transitional structure where people who haven't yet been licensed, because we're establishing it, can be on this advisory board. They're going to obtain their licensure, and I think that's all that the amendment is doing. Do you think the amendment needs to be written differently, or I'm not sure what the issue is?
Possibly. As I say, I'll say again, a person who is engaged in the practice of genetic counseling on the day before the effective date. And so genetic counseling exists before the effective date of this bill, is that correct?
Well, Representative Sadler, there are genetic counselors working in the state of Alaska, yes.
Okay.
They aren't licensed yet, and the purpose of the bill is to establish licensure so they can be reimbursed.
I'm just still fumbling with the fact that we have someone who's engaged in the practice, which has not yet been created.
Why don't we go to Monty Worthington, who is online and is one genetic counselor who's testified and I think has shared amendments with...
Actually, the drafter might be more appropriate person to ask.
Is the drafter online?
Not yet, but I can call.
Tell you what, Representative Sadler, we're going to try to get the drafter...
That'd be great.
Online. So tell you what I'll do. I will, at this time, withdraw Amendment 3 or A.3. We can return to it when we get the drafter online. So I withdraw Amendment 3. At this time, Amendment 3 is withdrawn. We're going to go to Amendment 4 or A.4 from Representative Colombe. And Representative Colombe, do you wish to offer that amendment?
I move Amendment 4. I'll object.
And go ahead, Representative Colon, please describe your amendment.
Yeah, so this is deleting a section, page 5, lines 25 through 28. And it's basically under the section of temporary license. So the bill allows for a temporary license for up to a year. But then it says, if they're working under temporary license, they have to pass an exam. This section says, but if they pass the exam, they can renew their license for another year until they pass the exam. And so my amendment just says, no, if you fail the exam, you're going to have to, you don't get a temporary license. You're going to have to pass the exam and go through the licensure process.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Clem. I was going to ask at this time, Monty Worthington. Mr. Worthington, could you weigh in, and do you think that the amendment that Representative Colom has described would work in practice if incorporated in this bill?
Yeah, hello. This is Monty Worthington through the chair. And the exam that genetic counselors take to get certification is the American Board of Genetic Counseling Board exam. And it is not an easy exam to pass. Typically, people on their first time attempting this test have about a 70 to 80% pass rate, 20 to 30% failure rate. This is normally done in the first year after someone graduates the program and is starting their practice. And they normally do work under temporary licenses. Sometimes the failure rate is even much higher. Last springtime in 2025, the board exam had only a 53% pass rate. It was a difficult exam. And so it is not uncommon for a genetic counselor graduate to not pass the board exam on the first go-around, and they're only offered every 6 months. So you have 6 months waiting period before you can attempt again. So typically this is kind of standard practice to allow another opportunity if a person doesn't pass on their first try without them essentially being losing their first employment they have because they can't practice after that time. So this is, I think, a typical practice with most licensure bills to give that second opportunity just because it is not just because you passed a program, gotten through a program, you're necessarily going to pass the board exams on your first try.
Okay. Can I go to Representative Carrick for a question and then circle back to Representative Colom?
Yes, through the co-chair to Mr. Worthington. Is there anything that somebody on a temporary license is limited doing versus somebody who's passed the examination?
As this bill is written, I do not believe there are limitations except that they have to work under a supervisor, whether that be a genetic counselor or a physician.
Okay, and just a brief follow-up.
Yep.
Through the co-chair. So if they've passed the test and they're not on a temporary license, a genetic counselor under this legislation would be able to work without supervision. I just want to make sure that's what you said, but I just want to make sure that's I'm hearing it correctly.
Yeah, that's the typical arrangement, is that someone's working under a supervisor until that point when they're themselves licensed.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, is there further discussion on this amendment? Yeah. Representative Sattler.
Thank you. Through the chair to Mr. Monty, I believe. The supervision by a licensed genetic counselor or physician, could that be over telecommunications or would that have to be in person?
Oh, it could certainly not be through telecommunications, yeah. And I'm looking for the language in the bill as we speak, just so I speak correctly how this was written.
Sir, did you say it could not? I didn't hear your words. I didn't hear, please repeat that statement, please.
I believe it can be done remotely through telemedicine.
To clarify, so the supervision could be done remotely by Zoom, essentially, right?
Yeah.
Thank you. And I guess follow up then, Mr. Chair?
Go ahead, Representative Sattler, and then we'll go.
So the supervising genetic counselor would not have to be licensed in Alaska, is that correct? It could be someone licensed in California?
Mr. Worthington, did you hear that? Could the supervisor be
I did.
Someone?
I didn't realize that question was to me.
Yeah.
As the bill language is written, it says they will be working under the general supervision of a licensed genetic counselor or licensed physician. It does not clarify the state of licensure in the bill as written.
So to follow up, to be clear, that could be a physician license in elsewhere than Alaska, or a genetic counselor license in a different state that was not Alaska, correct?
As the bill is written, it simply said licensed genetic counselor.
And I'll go to Evan Anderson as well. Go ahead, Evan Anderson.
For the record, Evan Anderson, staff to Rep. Fields, through the chair to Rep. Sadler. I believe our statutes only refer to licensure within the state of Alaska, so this does not refer to a licensed genetic counselor from some other state. When we're referring to licensure within Alaska statute, it has the meaning that somebody's licensed to practice in this state.
Okay. Well, it would... For clarity, it would not be my intent that this bill would allow supervision from a licensed genetic counselor or physician who was not licensed in Alaska.
Right. And I think that's consistent with how we understand the bill as well, Representative.
I just want to make sure that's clear.
Representative Coloma is next, I believe.
Well, I was just going to do a
wrap-up. Okay. Good time for wrap-up. I don't see any other questions, okay. So go ahead. And I guess I guess I should ask, is an objection maintained?
It's maintained.
Okay. Go ahead and wrap up, Representative Clum.
Okay. So 2 points to what was said. First, most professions have some kind of test or exam or multiple exams that they have to pass. It's not our issue that they only offer it once a year, twice a year. If they they should probably offer it more often if they have a 50% pass rate, in my opinion. But that's not really my issue, but my biggest thing is I want to make sure the committee knows the weight of the information that a genetic counselor gives people. This makes people make life decisions based on what they've been told. So I don't need someone who can't pass the exam, who's just got into the profession, telling people they have, you know, genetic histories and they didn't read it right, or especially prenatal care. I think this is really serious information responsibility they have, and if they can't pass it on the first time, they need to wait till they can pass their exam and get licensure then. But just the scope of practice, they obtain individual family and medical histories. They discuss features, natural history, means of diagnosis, genetic factors, management of risk for genetic and medical conditions, identify and order and coordinate genetic lab tests, integrate genetic lab test results and other studies with the patient, personal and family medical history. So, like, just to reiterate, these people aren't, like, they're telling, there's a possibility, if you're not skilled, of giving the wrong genetic information to people, and that can have life consequences to families. And so I don't think that they should have a cushion to fail the exam and keep on a temporary license. I think that it should be more strict than that.
Okay. Thanks, Representative Clum. Is the objection maintained?
The objection is removed.
Okay. So seeing no further objection, Amendment 4 or A.4 does pass. Representative Cologne, would you like to offer Amendment 5?
I will not be offering Amendment 5 at this time.
Okay, thank you. Would you like to offer Amendment 6?
I move Amendment 6.
And
I object for the purposes of discussion.
So Amendment 6 just removes the whole idea of the Genetic Counseling Advisory Council. I was glad to see the First Amendment passed to keep the cost down. Some of it was cost, but like was said in the hearings before, there's not that many counselors in the state. It will be hard to fill the advisory council anyway. ASMA is basically appointing these people, and I feel like the medical board and the department can deal with the licensure, the regulations, whatever that can happen. They certainly can get consultation from genetic counselors, but I don't think it's needed to have an entire advisory council.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you, Representative Clum. My understanding is the genetic counselors do feel somewhat strongly about having an advisory council, and I want to go to Mr. Worthington to speak to that.
Yeah, this is Monty Worthington through the chair, responding to Representative Field. So of the 36 states that have licensure in place, only 15 of them don't use the structure of having a genetic counseling advisory council that works under a state medical board. And the real purpose of the advisory council is to take some workload away from the state medical board in terms of developing that expertise specific to genetic counseling. not so much to the administer the licensure itself, but to establish sort of the guardrails, such as what states might view take their licensure requirements as adequate to meet the same standard that ours do, and providing that advisement to the state medical board as then they administer that licensing process. It is not a paid board, and as you know, First Amendment passed, it wouldn't even be reimbursed for travel or expenses, and I think in that it would really reduce costs to the state for this administration, whereas the state medical board will need to develop that expertise in-house into the nuances of licensure as it applies to genetic counseling.
Representative Colomb, not seeing anyone else in the queue, I guess my concern is we are, I think, trying to build some expertise across a diverse set of providers, and the larger providers have these genetic counselors right now, maybe the smaller providers don't. And my concern in eliminating the advisory council is we want understanding of how genetic counselors can work in teams to be widespread across different provider types. So I'm pretty hesitant to eliminate it, just especially given that we've eliminated the costs and travel. Obviously, it could work. I do kind of want to be deferential to the counselors who it seems like they are willing to be very involved in helping develop a structure. So that's just my hesitation in eliminating it at this time. And I think it was Representative Sadler, Carrick, Nelson.
So thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, could you, Mr. Monty Worthington, could you remind me again what your position is in relation to the practice? Who do you represent? What interests do you represent?
I work as a genetic counselor at the Providence Cancer Center. This is Monty Worthington through the chair. Excuse me.
Thank you very much, sir. And thanks, Mr. Chair.
Yep. Next up, Representative Carrick.
Yeah, through the co-chair, you know, I thought about offering this exact amendment, and at first when it was drafted, it was not exactly what I was looking for, but I definitely considered the idea of still offering it. I think one of the challenges I have with this amendment is right now genetic counselors are going to have their decisions ultimately made by the state medical board for the profession, and I don't really want the state medical board to be the ultimate guiding force on this profession. I think that advisory council really helps to ensure that genetic counselors are the ones making the advisory decisions for their profession, and I believe that's actually pretty important for the state medical board to have their input for consideration as opposed to just making decisions for a profession. The vast majority of the people on asthma will not have the experience in the profession. So I really respect where this amendment's coming from, but I don't support it either.
Next up is Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. I support this amendment. Just looking from what we have heard over the past few hearings, it seems like the entirety of the advisory council is going to be made up of the people that it's going to serve, which is all great, but it's kind of 100% of 100%. I think it would be better served either in the state medical board maybe just having someone with expertise somewhere else in the state, not necessarily having an entire council dedicated to this very small profession. I appreciate what you have done, Mr. Chair, through the First Amendment, but also would be encouraging to see this amendment pass as well.
Okay. Is there further discussion before we go to a wrap-up? Okay, seeing none, would you like to make wrap-up comments?
So just to reiterate, the testifier, I forget his name, sorry, said 15 states do this without an advisory council. So it can be done. Asthma made a point to come in, said they support it because they're part of team care. So they're integrated with these people, supposedly, with, you know, taking care of people. And it doesn't prohibit genetic counselors from having input with the board or collaborating with them. It's just not a big structured advisory council. It would put more on the medical board, but since they support it, I suspect that they would have considered that part, and so I just think it'd be more efficient if we could just keep the advisory council out.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Colomb. Will the Secretary call the roll?
Representative Saylor.
Yes.
Representative Freer.
No.
Representative Carrick.
No.
Representative Nelson.
Yes.
Representative Colomb.
Yes.
Co-Chair Fields.
No.
Co-Chair Hall.
No.
3A, 4nay.
So by a vote of 4-3, Amendment 6A.6 does not pass. Representative Colomb, would you like to offer Amendment 7?
I move Amendment 7.
Object for the purposes of discussion.
So my amendment in the bill it provides for a genetic counselor who does not satisfy the requirements for a licensure initially can get a license by serving in the field for 10 years, qualify for licensure using 3 letters of recommendations. That these options, other than going to school, getting an exam, going for licensure, paying the fees, I think it's a serious profession, and I don't think someone should get licensed because they have 3 letters of recommendation and pay the fees.
Okay.
So that's basically what it says.
Thanks, Representative Colomb. Representative Hall, do you maintain your objection?
I remove my objection.
Okay. Seeing no further objection, Amendment 7 passes. Representative Sadler, would you like to offer Amendment 8?
Yes, I would, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, I move Amendment number 8.
Object.
Very good. Well, Mr. Chair, I'll speak to that. This would amendment would eliminate the category and practice of genetic counseling intern. You know, we've heard the argument that genetic counseling is a discipline. It requires highly trained people with the education and experience and skills necessary to comprehend complex health conditions, understand generational genetic histories, apply statistical modeling, and practice sensitive patient counseling skills. In fact, there's only 7 people in the state that are meeting the standard in practice, but this bill would allow college students to practice genetic counseling as genetic counseling interns, as long as they met several conditions, 3 conditions. Those are to be enrolled in an accredited genetic counseling or medical genetics certification program, if they're performing services integral part of the study of the student, and if they were providing those services under direct supervision of a supervising licensed genetic counselor. If they're enrolled in a genetic counseling program, a little bit of research showed that those are 2-year programs. I couldn't find that they were either in a 6-year program, they could be in their freshman year, but even at the best, at the start of a 2-year master's program, they could be enrolled and therefore meet that standard. That's just a little early. Second, if the person was performing services that are an integral part of the student study, well, I would certainly hope that the services they are providing were an integral part of a student's study. But there's no verification if they were learning or making progress. Again, the idea that this is a high-consequence, high-demanding profession would indicate that we shouldn't have students without a demonstrable success, even at the student level, providing services that they could bill insurance and Medicaid for. The third condition is that the intern would be providing services under the direct supervision of a supervising licensed genetic counselor. Again, there's only 7 of them in the state, and that direct supervision definition includes demonstration, which means the student will be watching a licensed counselor provide services directly to a patient, observation, which means the genetic counselor will be demonstrating to the student how to provide that counseling, and coaching, which means the licensed counselor will be guiding the student as they provide genetic counseling. I'm not sure what actual skills an intern would have or need to possess to justify them practicing intern-level genetic counseling, even under the admittedly amorphous conditions. I just don't think the field is developed enough and the pipeline of trainees robust enough to allow them to practice in this new area of medicine, especially early in their educational career. If it's important that this counseling service be provided by experienced professionals, we should limit the practice to such professionals and not extend it to first-year college students in the program. There may be a time in the future when interns might be appropriate, but that time is clearly not now.
Thanks, Representative Sadler. I think interns in this case is more like a medical resident, which is not first year in college, but part of an advanced degree. Okay. And my concern is that this is kind of an important part of the professional development pipeline, again, akin to medical residency. But I would like to turn to Mr. Worthington, if he's still available, to talk about how do genetic counselor interns
work. There's nothing in the bill that indicates it's a residency. It just says enrolled in a certified program.
Okay. I still want to turn to Mr. Worthington because I think there actually is a lot of definition in the way it works in the field. I think Mr. Worthington might have dropped off. I'm going to see if we can get him back online. But Representative Saylor, this is something that we talked about in committee, and basically the genetic counselor interns do not provide that kind of advice when they're in their first year. They do provide guidance under the direct supervision of a fully trained genetic counselor toward the end of their academic training. And again, this is a postgraduate degree. Yes. So I'm comfortable with the intern structure, and I support it insofar as, you know, you always have a chicken and egg struggle when you have new technology. This is a new-ish profession. So I think probably our goal would be that there be more than 7 genetic counselors practicing in the state. And then I would see the intern structure as probably being necessary to responsibly grow that field. I'm going to go to Representative Carrick, and then we'll go back to Representative Saylor.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. I just wanted to add that licensing is new, but genetic counseling as a profession is not. And so one of the arguments for this amendment is that this is a new field, and we should be careful about, you know, having internship programs. But I also recall from the testimony a question was asked about this section, and if we get Mr. Worthington back, I think he can answer better. But there was some discussion that certification programs in genetic counseling or medical genetics take place during the later stages of somebody's medical career, not in the earliest stages. So I think this is a really important, you know, workforce and profession development section of the legislation, and I strongly support it being in the bill.
Go ahead, Representative Saylor.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Nothing in the bill I've read indicates that the educational attainment is a residency. My understanding of a residency for a medical doctor is after 4 years of undergraduate and 4 years of medical school, then a med student would enter a residency.
Yeah.
My research shows that the preliminary requirement to enter a genetic counseling program is a 4-year degree, and genetic counseling is generally a 2-year degree. So it could be somebody who graduated from, got a BA or BS in June, and in September is enrolled in a genetic counseling certification program and would be therefore qualified to practice and bill as a junior genetic counselor intern. And that just does not seem appropriate to me.
Okay. Well, I think our phone system had dropped Monty Worthington, but I think he's back on. And Mr. Worthington, maybe you could talk about what does an intern mean in the context of genetic counseling, and could you expound further on Representative Saylor's amendment? Thank you.
Yeah, so this is Monty Worthington through the chair responding to Representative Field. So the genetic counseling intern role is something that happens throughout genetic counseling training. It is how we get actually the bulk of our training in what we do. We begin rotations typically towards the end of the first year, and it is the bulk of the time spent in the second year and the summer before the second year is in these rotations in different types of clinics. This is an essential part to our training. Without this, we wouldn't be able to do our jobs when we graduate from our program. We might understand some of the theory of it, but not actually how it's done in practice. And we regularly, at least once or twice a year, take on students at the Providence Cancer Center from programs, and they are under direct supervision, meaning that they are never with a patient without one of us who are working as a genetic counselor with them in the room to make sure that everything is done appropriately and the advice they give is appropriate to the individual they're working with. This is not just a pipeline for genetic counselors to be trained nationwide, but for genetic counselors that might be interested in working in Alaska, it creates opportunities for them to see what it is like to work up here and for the genetic counselors to work up here to get some experience with the aspiring genetic counselors. It's really meaningful to be part of the training of these young genetic counselors, and like I say, it is an essential part of the program. Now, to the analogy towards medical school, typically rotations in medical school start sometime in the second half of that 4 years of their medical school training. So they also go through this. It is a bit different than a residency where some people, but sometimes individuals are working without supervision directly. This is the direct supervision of these students to help them gain the skills they will need to be genetic counselors when they graduate their program.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Worthington. Go ahead, Representative Sadler.
Thank you. My objection stands, sir. There may be a time, as I said, when to allow genetic counselor interns to practice may be justifiable, but that time is not now. There's nothing that would prevent somebody who was a student from observing and learning at the hands of or the computer screen of somebody who is supervised, and they can certainly learn. That is available, but to allow them to hang out a shingle as an intern and bill insurance for those services to me seems inappropriate, and so I will stick with my amendment.
Okay. Well, I think we've had a good debate on this, so will the secretary call the roll?
Representative Klum.
Yes.
Representative Sadler.
Yes.
Representative Freer.
No.
Representative Carrick.
No.
Representative Nelson.
Yes.
Co-chair Fields.
No.
Co-chair Hall.
No.
3A, 4nay.
So by a vote of 3-4, Amendment 8 does not pass. I will now, we had a discussion on Amendment 3. Let's circle back to Amendment 3. That'll be our last amendment. I will offer Amendment 3.
Object for the purposes of discussion.
Thank you, and I believe we now have Conran Gunther online. Mr. Gunther, I guess you didn't hear the discussion. Representative Sadler was basically trying to understand this transitional language. Maybe you could just briefly comment on why do we have this? Why did Ledge Legal recommend this transition language be added to the bill? Thank you.
Through the chair, this is Conran Gunther from Ledge Legal. In the current version of the bill, in Section 11, there is a provision that allows currently practicing genetic counselors to practice in the state without a license for a year after the effective date of the bill. As I've heard some other people refer to during the course of this committee, there are currently people who are practicing genetic counseling in the state, even though it is not currently a licensed profession. The bill also requires that at the state medical board's first meeting, they shall appoint licensed genetic counselors to the board. That's an issue here because there is likely not going to be anyone who is able to become licensed under the structure of this bill in the time frame allowed there. So this transition provision added to Amendment 3 merely addresses that by allowing the exempt genetic counselors who are currently practicing to serve on the board during that exemption period while they are practicing without a license.
Okay. Go ahead, Representative Sadler.
Does that answer your question?
Yeah. Thank you. Through the chair, Mr. Gunther, this is Representative Sadler. I think where I hang up is the language I've heard, currently practicing as a genetic counselor. If someone is not licensed, what is the standard of practice for someone to practice as a genetic counselor? Can anyone simply say, I'm a genetic counselor and be one?
So through the chair, Representative Sadler, this is Conran Gunther from Ledge Legal again. I can't speak to what the definition of practice of genetic counselor is. It is not something that I believe is defined in this bill. That language is currently used in the bill already in Section 11. That exemption applies to a person who is engaged in the practice of genetic counseling. So it is just kind of the language is used in the amendment to capture the same people who are captured by the exemption provided in Section 11.
Go ahead, Representative Sadler.
Go ahead.
Yeah, to the extent, that you want clarification on what the practice of genetic counseling currently looks like, that would be a great question for someone who is in that field. As far as what that means after this bill were to be enacted, if it were to pass, That's something that the state medical board could define in regulation, but currently is not defined in the bill. The only thing defined in the bill that I see is, you know, kind of the confines of the licensing structure, and that a licensed genetic counselor is someone licensed in the state.
Okay. And Mr. Worthington, maybe you want to explain how the practice of genetic counseling has, in practice, moved faster than state law. How do you work as a genetic counselor prior to passage of a bill defining what a genetic counselor is?
This is Monty Worthington through the co-chair, responding to co-chair. Yeah, this is one of the main points of this bill. Genetic counseling is not currently regulated in Alaska. That's what this licensure would provide, is a definition of who can represent themselves as genetic counselors. There is a scope of practice defined in the bill under Article 2, beginning of regulation of genetic counselors, that details the scope of what genetic counselors do and are essentially the confines of their scope of work under this bill.
Okay, Representative Sandler.
And if I may characterize what you said, Mr. Worthington, through the chair, that currently there, genetic counseling is not a license, it's not regulated. It, in some sense, does not exist yet, and that's where I get hung up on the plain language. Someone who is practicing genetic counseling the day before the date of this act, which is what authorized practice of genetic counseling, it just does not seem to make sense on its face.
Representative Sadler, I think the reality is genetic counselors are employed by our largest health care providers in the state.
But the employment, sir, is not what the point is. It's the practice. You know.
So the largest health care providers are determining how genetic counselors work as part of a healthcare team. If this bill passed, we would also define it in state law.
Yeah, and I won't believe the point, but until the act is passed, none of that operates. There is no such thing as practice genetic counseling. You know, you can hire me as a genetic counselor, the Cancer Center can pay me, you can call me genetic counselor, but there's nothing as I am.
I understand that. Okay, so Representative Hall, do you maintain your objection to the amendment?
I've removed my objection.
Okay.
Object.
Representative Sadler objects, so will the Secretary call the roll.
Representative Carrick.
Yes.
Representative Nelson.
No.
Representative Sadler.
No.
Representative Freer.
Yes.
Representative Colomb.
Yes.
Co-Chair Fields.
Yes.
Co-Chair Hall.
Yes.
5 yea, 2 nay.
So by a vote of 5-2, Amendment 3 does pass. I don't believe there are any further amendments. Is there any more committee discussion before we take action on the bill? Okay. And Mr. Worthington, thank you to you and the other genetic counselors who shared your experience from the field. Representative Hall, do you have a motion?
Mr. Co-Chair, I move to report HB 293, version 34-LS1222/A. As amended with individual recommendations and accompanying fiscal notes.
Is there any objection? Seeing any objection, House Bill 293 does pass as amended. That is the last item on our agenda. So at 5:23, we are adjourned.